God,
God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. So if you could just raise your virtual blue hand or wave at the camera or make yourself known somehow. We would just like to welcome you. All right. So let's see if you would like your note. Okay, never mind. All right. And Bobby, Brother Bobby, would you read the preamble for us?
Yeah. Hey, name's Bobby. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bobby.
Hey, preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for a membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Thank you, Bobby. All right, the format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to welcome Gary B. from Indianapolis, Indiana, to tell his story. After he does so, then we'll take a break at the top of the hour, call for announcements, pass the seventh tradition basket, et cetera, and then we'll get the opportunity to ask some questions. So keep all that in mind. Sit back and relax, and I won't take another minute of his time. Thank you again, Gary, for coming to share with us tonight. Gary B.
Thank you, David. I appreciate being invited to this. I've been doing a lot of these lately since the Zoom thing has started. And the idea of just looking at a screen and trying to tell my story just isn't quite the same as when you're looking at people out there and getting reactions from something good you said or something stupid you said. So that's kind of where I start. I'm Gary. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is December 3rd, 1964. That was the day that I showed up at a place called the Wyoming State Hospital in Evanston, Wyoming. And I'll tell you more about that and how that happened here in a minute. The first time I got a hold of enough to drink to find out what it was about, like, there was a time when I'd watch my dad drink and he would change. He would just change, you know, from kind of a grumpy, very intense guy. He wasn't mean and I wasn't mistreated by him. But if he got two or three drinks in him, he got to be a lot more fun. And I'd watch that with him. And then, I grew up on an experimental farm outside of Cheyenne, Wyoming, that had several families that lived on it. And they, you had the cowboys working on it and the horticulturalists and the people like that. Their mission was to see what they could grow at 6,000 feet above sea level in a very short growing season. Nothing like y'all have done in Virginia. But the kids that were out there, I was the third from the youngest. And they went up to some of them were 4 years older than I. So I had a little problem kind of getting along with all that. But some days after work, we'd go down there and hang around the shop and all the hands there would show up and they'd break out the beer. And we'd watch what would happen with the adults down there when they were, hitting the booth. And it changed and it looked like a great deal of fun. And so, I was fascinated by it. So much so, I remember a time as a kid, my parents would take me down to one of the other homes there and we were in their kitchen and they opened the pantry door and I saw six shelves with all different kinds of bottles of liquor on it. And I never forgot that. And back then, back in the 40s, and, you know, you live out in the country, you never lock doors, you know, just do that. And I saw them leave to go to town on a Saturday and knew they weren't going to be back for a while. And so I went over there and went in their house and went straight to that pantry. I wasn't interested in anything else. And I got the sampling different bottles there. And most of them just tasted terrible. But something kind of changed a little bit in me. And then I got scared. So I put everything away and I took off. I never was caught. But that was my first thing around it. I still, the fascination was there. I was the kid going to school in Cheyenne, both in elementary school and junior high and high school. I was the one that was just terrified to have to talk in front of the class. I thought girls were really neat, but I was afraid to talk to them. And that's the other guys talking to them, dating them. It looked like a really good idea, but I couldn't pull it off. Just couldn't do it. So that was kind of part of my thing there. Got through school, didn't do too bad in school as a kid. I wasn't an academic genius, but I did just enough, got by, and would get B's and C's. And ended up as a sophomore in high school. And this thing, the guys talking with the girls and all that going on, I could see more of that happening. There's a time in high schools in Wyoming where the state basketball tournament is held over in Laramie. That's the time the high school kids and all that generally could get out without chaperones, you know, interfering with their activities. So two other fellows and myself were driving over there. And when we got there, the driver, Bob, he had a couple of lady friends who stopped by and picked up, and they went with us. And I'm sitting in the back seat of the car with two of them. Somebody said we ought to get some liquor. And so I found a guy to buy us a bottle of Four Roses whiskey. Then we went out and got some Coke. That's Coca-Cola. You got to explain that stuff anymore. And we passed the bottle around. And the first time it went around, I took a slug out of it like I'd watched the Cowboys do down there at the shops. Second time it came around, they took it away from me after a minute because I got a hold of a big slug of whiskey. And it was wonderful. I had the most profound change I've ever had in my life. I became everything I've ever wanted to be. I mean, it was great. Earlier I felt like I didn't belong with that group in that car. And after that whiskey hit me, I felt like I owned that group in that car. And it was great. I made a grab at one of the girls, she slapped me around pretty good. But here I am, 80 years old, and I'm still proud of that grab. A little while later, they got tired of me and decided to sober me up, took me to a truck stop and fed me coffee. It woke me up. It didn't sober me up. And I got in a beef with the cowboy, and he slapped me around a lot worse than that girl did. Later on, they were tired of me, didn't know what to do with me. I don't know what they did with me. All I can tell you is I woke up someplace in the morning, and I hurt in a large number of places. And I felt terrible, and I couldn't wait to go do it again. I woke up wondering if there's any more of that whiskey lesson. I didn't know, but that never left me. From that point on, I didn't want to be involved in any social event or anything else unless there was booze around. That was kind of how things started with me. And that was probably 16 years old. I never was keeping track with that. But it still was going to school. There came a night there, and I think I was junior in high school. And after a basketball game one night, a bunch of the kids had gone out to this large city park, Cheyenne, large for Cheyenne, city park where we'd all kind of go out. And there was a hot redhead there that I'd seen in the school and out there, and she's out there, and My friend John Farrow knew every girl in school and all that. So I asked, what's that girl's name? And he said, her name is Julie Bailey. He says, come on over, I'll introduce you. So he did and all that. We were introduced and talked, and she'd come to the park with another fella, but she went home that night with me. So that tells you something about Julie, doesn't it? It certainly wasn't me, I don't think. But that was kind of the beginning of things. Beginning of things for us. We dated mostly off and on, and I was a year older than she, so I graduated from high school in 58 and promptly went in the Army. And I was trying to carry correspondence with two or three different girls, and that got real confusing. So anyway, when I got out of the Army, I got out in 6 months with only one court-martial, and I left the Army with an honorable discharge. But got in that little trouble there, and I got out. And I got in town that day, and I thought, I'd like to see Julie. So I called this high school. Told her I was Julie's dad and that I had an emergency and I need to stop by and pick her up at the north door of the school. And so I drove over there and she came out the north door and saw me there and got in the car and went with me. So that tells you more about her. She thought she was in trouble or some of her family was sick or she didn't know. It was us. And so that's kind of how we started with all of that. And the whole time there, drinking was a big part of it, and I was done. We got married a year and a half later, and I was 19, and she was 18. And we had our first daughter in 6 months. She was an eight pound, 3 ounce premature baby, if you were looking at that. If you're looking at the calendar. And she figured that out as a teenager. She still thinks it's funny. But anyway, that was her life, how it was going. I was knocking around doing different jobs driving trucks working in tree nurseries. And as a senior in high school, I had a job with the a daily newspaper in Cheyenne, the evening paper. And my senior year of high school, I'd go down there early in the morning, and I was a sports editor till school started. And so I put together a sports page on that daily newspaper and go to work, go to school. And then on the weekends, I worked at a tree nursery to make money. It took a lot of money to take all that beer and gasoline. It was just what it was. Get home took a job. Julie's dad helped me find a job with, I think it was Beeman Beverage Company. And they were the people that had the Coors Bearer franchise. And so I went to work there. First day there, I'm getting ahead of myself. That was after I got sober. I'll get back to that. I'm sorry. Anyway, I was getting in more and more trouble, and the drinking was getting worse. The infidelity was getting worse, getting beat up badly here and there. And I was a hell of a fighter. I just wasn't a winner. And I got booted out of the house, which makes sense. At that point, we had three girls, and I was thrown out of the house. And I thought, that's okay. And I moved in with the Hams beer distributor. That didn't last long. It didn't take him long. And I wasn't a welcome guest there. And so I was homeless quickly. This one day, I bought my booze primarily by writing bad checks. Back then in Cheyenne, maybe we had three or four banks. And you could walk into any bar, and back on the back bar, they'd have counter checks. And so you go in there and say, give me a check. And they'd say, which bank? And it didn't matter because I didn't have an account in any of them. So they'd write my checks and I'd buy all my drinks and do that. And this one day I got into a liar's poker game with three or four early risers. And And I did real well. I had enough, cash to go over to my favorite bar and buy back two or three checks. And I had some left over and tried to get a large poker game going there and wouldn't have any luck. So I thought I'd call Julie and see if I could get back in the house. And I called and she answered. I told her I wanted to come up and see the kids and see. She said, sure, coming up. And so when I got there, her dad was there. And that meant that we had that talk. Yeah, you know, and I got to tell you, if there's any of the alcoholics sitting here, I'll guarantee you, you had that talk at least once with a parent, a friend, a relative, a boss. You've all had that talk. Only this one didn't quit. There was no way to lie myself out of it. I couldn't do it. And all that. And the only thing they knew to do back then in Cheyenne, they didn't know about AA then. There was AA there back in then in 64. But they didn't seem to know about it. All they knew is Julie had an uncle who would be taken up to that nut house every so often because he'd get out and couldn't stay sober. He wouldn't do it. Matter of fact, he died in the truck on his way up the last trip. He went into DTs and didn't make it on his last trip. That's an aside. But I told Julie's dad that I'd go up to Nut House if he'd take me. I didn't think that was all lying. Hell, it's only 400 miles. And he said, no, but I'll put you on a bus and take you down. And so we agreed to that, and he put me on a bus. I got off the bus about two-thirds of the way there in Rock Springs and found a liquor store, bought a pint of whiskey, got back on that, and that whiskey got me on to Evanston. It's a small town, and the biggest building in town is kind of over on, if you look east from downtown, you're looking up to the side of a mountain. On the side of that mountain is the Wyoming State Hospital, and you look, I stood there, I got off the bus and sitting there looking at it, and I thought it looked like opening shot on a horror movie just sitting up there. But I was sitting there looking at it, and a cop came up to me and said, you going up there? And I said, yeah, I guess so. So stick around a little bit and I'll give you a ride. I went along with that because he wasn't the first cop to give me a ride. But he did. He took me up there. And that was a big setting to me. I was just drunk enough to not be too scared. And I went in and the first thing they said was, are you here to participate in our alcoholic rehabilitation program? And I didn't know what it was, but it struck me that I was in a nut house, and maybe that was better than being a nut. And so I said, sure. And the next thing I know, I'm locked in a room, a little square room about the size of a jail with a little glass window in it. And I'd be laying on that cot, and I'd look in the window, and every so often somebody had their nose pressed against the glass looking in on me. I think that's larger to see if I was awake or alive or what. And that was my home for 3 or 4 days. They gave me something. Back then, the strongest thing they'd give you to withdraw from alcohol is called paraldehyde. And you could smell that stuff from about three counties away. But that wasn't what they gave me. And I just remembered what it was. If you watched the old 30s movies in that, they would talk about putting a knockout drug in somebody's drink. And that was a drug called Noctec, N-O-C-T-E-C. And that's what they were using for me to withdraw from all my drinking. And I was still sicker in hell with it, but I got through. After that was over, we had a little meeting with several people. And I don't remember much about it. And they took me up and put me in an alcoholic ward. And there might have been, the men's alcoholic ward might have been, maybe 25, 30 men in there. I was by far the youngest one. It was about a month before my 25th birthday. And we would be marched down to counseling sessions where sometimes nobody would say a damn word. And then we'd also be marched down to AA meetings. And they told us if we didn't go to the AA meeting, we had to change wards. And I'd seen some of those people that were in those wards, and so I was attracted to Alcoholics Anonymous, and so that's how I got there. And I watched them, and so I remember, I don't know which one it was, we did that for 16 weeks. I remember standing by the window watching the cars come up to the parking lot, because we knew alcoholics were going to be driving up from Salt Lake City or Ogden, and what few there were right there in that little town. And I'm looking out the cars in the parking lot, and I says, that can't be the alcoholics' cars, because they had chrome strips on both sides, and they you know, one-piece windshields. They weren't anything like those old cars I was driving with that. But they came in and they introduced themselves, and of the 20 plus or so of us that had to go to that meeting, the guests would come in and share their bit like we do when we're taking meetings into, you know, rehab centers or any of those places. And we didn't say anything except our name. I'm an alcoholic and I'm Gary. I'm an alcoholic and I'm David. And go around the room. But they would talk. And I don't know which meeting it was, but a guy talked. And he talked about blaming his sobriety on God. He said, I get up the morning now. And he says, I spend some time praying. And that's what that was a language I didn't grow up with. My dad was a horticultural scientist, and my mom was a mad atheist. And so I didn't know anything about God or Jesus or anything. I learned the Lord's Prayer in AA meetings. I didn't know that. I probably heard it, but wasn't paying attention. I'm real good at not paying attention. So. That made me uncomfortable. I didn't know what to think about that gospel. So anyway, that went on. You had to have some kind of help there. You had to have a job of some kind to do. And so I had a job where they'd march me up to the ward that had the physically sick people. And I was acting kind of like a nurse's aide and changing shitty sheets. And it wasn't the most pleasant job, but it kept me from just hanging down in the ward. And that. So anyhow. They kept me in there for 16 weeks, and that was their normal stay. I wasn't given time for bad behavior or good behavior. They just that was just it. And so we one night I got on a bus out of Evanston at 4 o'clock in the evening, and I arrived in Cheyenne 2 or 3 in the morning. And 2 or 3 in the morning back then, and probably pretty much now, not much goes on at 2 or 3 in the morning in Cheyenne. They let me off at the bus stop, and I figured I was going to have to walk up to Julie's parents' house where Julie and the kids were. And I walked to the door, and there's a police detective there who stopped me, and he says, you going up to the Bailey's house? And I said, yeah. He says, hop in, I'll give you a ride. Well, that's not the first time that cop had given me a ride, but that was this was more appreciative. We get in the car, and he gets it going down 16th Street, and he says, you know, Gary, there are just some people who really shouldn't drink. And I said, so you know where I've been? And he said, Gary, I've known where you've been just about every day since you were 16 years old. And so I like to tell that story because most of us, if you think about it, had somebody in their lives that was watching for us. I think that when the Denver Young People's Group would talk about that, we call those people our Eskimo. And that started with the story of the two drunks in the bar arguing about whether or not God existed. And this one guy says, I know God didn't exist. I can prove it. And they all, you know, the other guy says, oh, yeah, sure. He said, no, I can't. He said, you remember that bad blizzard we had about 3 months ago? And he says, yeah, he says, he said, I lost two dogs in that blizzard, and it was so cold, I figured I was going to die there. And then he stopped talking. And the guy said, yeah, well, what happened? He said, oh, some Eskimo came along, picked me up, took us all in, and brought us in. He said, that's why I don't have a God. So we all talk about our Eskimos, the people who have helped us. And I think that's interesting worth thinking about. I've never seen him again. And I, you know, I wish I had. I wasn't in Cheyenne long. We moved to Laramie, and I went to the University of Wyoming there. I got a free ride to college there, also paid for room and board and things like that. So that beat the hell out of looking for a job. But between the time I arrived home and had to go to Laramie, Dooley's dad got me a job down at Beeman Beverage Company, the Coors distributor there in town. And I went down there, and that first day they put me on the drove it down to Golden, Colorado, the Coors brewery, and loaded that truck up with beer. And we got back there that night. We loaded the beer onto the six-wheel delivery truck, and we took it out to the bars that most of them I had drank in. And a good bunch of them had my bad checks. And the difference was, when I hit that nut house, I was 6 foot 2 inches tall, and I weighed about 130 pounds. That's skinny, you know. Walk fast, your legs whistle. So I look different. I'm stacking the bear back in the cooler for him and all that. And he's looking at me funny, but he couldn't quite put it together with me. I was that much bigger. And I got a lot of exercise in that nut house too. So anyway, I got a payday from that, what it was. And I walked in that bar and I said, "You got a bad check sitting in your cash register door, I think. And he did. He had it right there. He still had it after all those months. And he bought it back. And he says, "You aren't going to keep delivering beer, are you?" I says, "No, we're going over to Laramie pretty quick." And then, but he says, "Well, I sure hope you make it with that." And I had two or three other, had enough money to buy two or three of those back. And we moved to Laramie, and I started school there, and found AA there. Laramie had one AA group, and I looked it up a while back. I think they have meetings every night of the week then, but then they had one, I think it was on Mondays and Thursdays. And we held it on the second story over, they were apartments over a corner drugstore there. And we'd go in there and make it. And I was a new kid in town, and I became the coffee maker and the literature getter outer and doing all that stuff because I was new and stupid. And so I would go down there and make coffee. And we had one of those 30-cup coffee pots. You're not in the A group unless you got those old West Bend coffee cups, pots, I don't think. We got one in here now, too. Anyway, I go down there and make coffee, and I'm still so scared. Okay, I'm sober those months and that. I'm going to AA, but I still wake up in the morning with that hole in my belly and the wind blowing through. And I'm still scared. It's tough for me to look you in the eye and carry on a conversation, and it's just so difficult for me to do that stuff. And I would sit there and look across the street at the Buffalo Bar while I'm waiting for the people to show up and the coffee to get made. Right across that street, and I drank in that once or twice in my time, but it had a neon lights out there that would flash, Buffalo, Buffalo, Buffalo. But the B was out. Damn thing said Buffalo, Buffalo, Buffalo. And I'd sit there and I'd grab the hold of my chair, and my knuckles would turn white. And I said, "Please God, help me with this. I can't do it." We had a meeting there, such as it was. There was only 8 or 10 people that would show up on a big night. And one of them was a guy named Frank, and Frank had a tough time staying sober. And the only time I recall talking about the 12 steps was the day he brought it up, and he says, "I've been sober longer now than I've ever been in my life." And he says, "I think the answer to this thing is the third step." He says, "I haven't had a drink since I had the third step." And the following Saturday, old Frank came down drunk, and I thought, "I'm not screwing with that third step." And that was it. Graduated with a 4-year degree and 3 in good grades. Surprised hell out of my dad. And moved to Denver. And when I got to Denver, I found the first meeting closest to me was in the biggest basement of an old mansion, it was an older couple, and it was their meeting. And I don't remember any conversation with them or anybody else. It's all about just don't drink and you'll be okay. If I could just don't drink and not be okay, I wouldn't need this program. And That's not what about. So anyway, another young guy came in there, Joe, and we'd go to that meeting. After the meeting, he and I go find a cup of coffee somewhere and something to eat and sit there and figure out how we had to rewrite the first portion of the fifth chapter. We thought it was pretty screwed up. And then one day came when we were all over Joe's house and his wife was listening to the two of us bellyache, and she told us to get the hell out. She says, "You're the sorriest two people I know in AA. I know quite a bit." She was sober in AA. And she says, "Get out of here." And she says, "Why don't you go downtown? There's a young people's group downtown. And maybe you can find somebody there you can connect with and do that." Joe got all puffed up and looked at me and said, "Come on, Brown, the girls there are going to be better looking anyway." So he's for us today. It is this day, that's why we went. But what I ran into there, was my old bad attitude. I looked at all these kids, and they were all about my age, but I had nearly 4 years of sobriety at that point. So I thought I could go in there and tell them how the cow ate the cabbage, that didn't work. They talked about the big book and the steps. And I remember getting the big book and tried to read it, and I thought, that sounds kind of monotonous, put it down. Later on, I tried reading the 12 and 12, and it was easier to read, but it didn't connect. There was just something about it. It didn't work. And so we went went to the young people's group. They talked big book, and it wasn't long after that that we decided, and I was much a part of it, there's a new guy in town who'd gotten out of prison from Canyon City, named Don P. And he showed up there, and he had been taking the book to the book and the steps in that prison. And he knew what he was doing about it, and he was very gifted, very charismatic, and capable of sharing that with us. And so we decided to have it over at Lee's house. He had a good-sized house up on Goat Hill. They named it Goat Hill because of the goats. that's how you know. Watch where you step and you get up the porch. And anyway, we started in there, and we opened the book right up to the forge to the first edition. And we read it and we shared on it. And then we got into the doctor's opinion. We found out that might be the most important part of the book if you're a new alcoholic coming in here. You need to find out what that disease is. And going back just a little bit, when I went in that hospital, they diagnosed me as a chronic alcoholic. Back in those days, you were either a chronic alcoholic or an acute alcoholic. I had always known I was an acute alcoholic, but not an acute alcoholic. And the difference is, the chronic alcoholic are the alcoholic who drank like I did. Early in their drinking, that became all they knew to do. That was it. That night, that was the greatest thing that happened to me, and I wanted to do that again and again and again. And the acute alcoholic is those of us who seem to be able to drink normally for a time, some of them quite long times, and then they pass on into alcoholism. And I've got a lot of experience today in my 5 years working with people. There's a kind of a distinct difference. The chronic alcoholic who hit it so hard and hit AA first, and acute alcoholic aren't still quite thinking the same. The acute alcoholics that I've got, the doctors at the psychiatric center wanted me to come work with them, and that didn't really relate to my kind of drinking. Because they'd had some success in life with careers and businesses and professions. They had that and somehow do that. And the guys I was hanging around with had these horrible stories. They weren't the nice guys. They were guys like me that had drank like that. And I'd work with them for a while, and then I'd have to find somebody else to help them. And generally, that somebody else is somebody that worked out of the 12 and 12. And that's fine. It works for those people, and they're sober. And I think that's a huge difference between us. There are probably some out there at your meeting there that disagree with me, but that's been my experience. we got to the first step. I fully conceded my own self that I was an alcoholic, and I had no pretenses that I was anything like other people. I just wasn't, and that was very much a part of me. And I really knew that, and that went fast. And when we moved on into the fourth chapter, and we agnostics, I had learned that I can't not drink, and I can't stop if I start drinking. And that was clear. That was a great reminder with that. And I was getting more comfortable with the idea of a higher power. I wasn't fully buying into it, but I was getting more comfortable with it. And I remember us talking about that at one of the our meetings. And my friend Tom shared his experience around that, and it was talking, and he had been sent to a psychiatric center in Denver called Mount Airy, A-I-R-Y, Mount Airy for the airheads, I guess, and their treatment was the aversion treatment, and that's a medieval treatment. I don't know if it goes on today now, but back then, the treatment, while you were in this hospital, the treatment room was just a room, square room. The middle room was a kind of a barber chair thing that would have a pot that would sit in front of or move away from whoever in that. And they gave him some antabuse, and he could have anything to drink in there. Had all his liquor bottles up on the wall, and he could take a drink. And the idea of that is you drink on top of the antabuse, and he'd get so violently sick, and he could watch himself throw up in the mirror. And he just watched the whole process is doing. The idea of that was he was, afterwards, having done that, he'd be so averse to it, he'd never take another drink. And Tom said it worked. He said it really did. He hadn't had reason or excuse to take antabuse since. And so we went on with that life. We kind of went on in the book. We get to the fifth chapter. We're looking at the third step. And Lee had an idea. By that time, the girls had left, and there's 14 of us. And we'd read in the fifth chapter and coming up to the third step prayer. And my buddy Lee, who is also 55 years old, lives in Grand Junction, Colorado, and still trying to help people in the book and the steps. But he said he had an idea. He wanted us men to stand up, hold hands, and read/pray the third step prayer together. The reason he wanted to do that was he had been attending other meetings. Many of them were four-step meetings, and he had asked people why they hadn't taken a inventory yet. And some of them said because they hadn't taken the third step yet. He says, the reason I want to do that, if you guys later on after we do this and you hear me telling somebody I haven't written inventory because I haven't taken the third step yet, you can tell them I'm a damn liar because you saw me do it. And that was good enough logic for us. I was very uncomfortable standing up in that room, holding hands with a room full of men and being seen praying. I guess I don't know which one was worse, but we did, and we said that together. After the meeting, I went out in the car and got in my car, and I sat there for a minute, and I asked God to listen to that prayer. I can't stand this stuff much longer. This is just too painful. I can't do it anymore. And I went on home. The next night, I'd made a deal with Julie. I wanted to go to an AA meeting that was just down the road from where we live. And she wanted to go to an Al-Anon meeting, just down the road from where we live. AA meeting started at 7 and ended at 8, and her Al-Anon meeting started at 8. So we made a deal, and the deal was I could go ahead and go to my meeting, and before she left, she tucked the girls in, and then I would hurry home after the meeting and tuck them in and go to bed and do that. And so that was our deal. I went to the meeting, and I went in there, and the only chair in there when I got there was next to a big guy, a big lawyer named Big Frank McKibben. If you want to find some talks by Big Frank McKibben, get a hold of Rusty out in California. He'll have takes his. But he was a lawyer, and he was big, and he was strong, and he was known as a bar battler, but he could beat you to death with words just as easy. And he was a step Nazi, and he would badmouth anybody that wasn't taking steps to the book. Wasn't the most popular guy in Denver, But those of us that were getting sober and had the tougher lives, we loved him. But I didn't love him. I was terrified of him. But the only seat in that meeting was right next to him. And so I went in there and sat down. Meeting with whatever it was, I don't remember. We stood up, said the Lord's Prayer, and for some reason, Frank and I sat down again afterward. And I don't think I instigated it. I just remember us sitting down. And I looked over at him, and I said, Frank, you got to understand something. You don't scare me one damn bit anymore. And he reared back, and he laughed, and he hugged me, and that's when I thought I was going to die. I got in the car, and I sat down in it, but my butt didn't hit the seat. I hope all of you have had that experience. And I get home, it feels like I'm floating. I go in the door, and I go to kiss the baby goodbye. Good night. She's asleep downstairs. I go upstairs where the two older girls are and went to the oldest girl's room. We chatted for a minute, kissed her goodnight. I went into Patty, and she's crying. Patty had been diagnosed with ulcer as a very young child. I think she was maybe 6 or 7. So I went down, got her a glass of milk, and I came back, got it up to her, and she's drinking the milk. And I remember some of the jokers I worked with in this office I was working. I was one of the early members to do executive recruiting and things like that, and I lived on the phone and that. But some of the people in there doing that were very aggressive Christians, tongue-talking Christians, and they were always talking about praying for people for whatever, for healings and all that stuff. I was always uncomfortable when they started doing that, and I'd stick to my work. But I didn't know what else to do. And I asked her if she wanted to pray, and she did. And so I held her hand and put my other hand on her stomach, and I said a prayer. That's all I can tell you. I have no clue what I said, no idea. I don't think I knew what I said as I was walking out. I'm sure it had nothing to do with me. And I went downstairs, and I sat in the chair, floated in the chair until Julie got home that night. Several weeks later, and I can't tell you, weeks or months, get home, coming home from your walk in the house, and Julie's cooking green chili verde. And she's not out from New Mexico and California and Texas. I feel sorry for you because green chili is just wonderful. But anyway, one of the girls, the oldest girl, said, well, what's Patty going to eat? She can't eat that. And says, Patty says, I can too. I haven't had a tummy ache in a long time. I just add a little bit to that story. A year ago, Thanksgiving Eve, it had been 2 years, it would have been 98. Excuse me, I got my ear. Yeah, it'd been 2018. And I gave a talk there, and Patty was there, our middle daughter and her older sister wanted to come to that. And I'm talking, I told that story, and I looked at her, and I said, I don't think she's ever had a tummy ache since. She says, that's right. So I just thought, throw that out. I don't care what you do with it. It's my story and stuff. We did fine. We had a lot of fun at that young people's group. We had a lot of sobriety. We went through the 12 steps energy. When we, after that third step was done, the 14 men that took it, 13 of us have either died sober or are still sober. Two of us, Bob just quit, had been active on the circuit talking around the world. And Bob just gave that up. He's done. And he's not angry about it. He's just done. But Lee has got all that done. Eddie Durkin got drunk and froze to death down in the slums of Denver, down on Old Larimer Street. He had a wooden leg to start with. And he'd go out and get drunk, and he'd come back to the meeting and ask us to help him go find his leg. And so that last time, we didn't have to go looking for it, but we've been around. While I'm thinking about it, there's a lady named Shelly M. who lives in Arizona half the time and in Alaska half the time. She was a member of that Denver Young People's Group, and she has 50 years of sobriety. So that's pretty much surprising, isn't it, that we could come out of that. And Bob and Ernie both live in Denver. The oldest sobriety still lives in Las Vegas in that group. He's got to be 61 or 2 years old. Had trouble with the business I was in, gotten a beef with my partner, and started looking for something else to do in the mid-70s. And Julie and I said a prayer, got a call from a good friend of ours in Nashville, Tennessee. He says, you want to come out to Indianapolis work? I need somebody to cover Midwest in my business. And I thought, that's crazy. Julie and I had prayed about what we were going to do about this job situation. And that night I went to the young people's group and said, do you think that was an answer to my prayer? And this girl used to drive over to Kansas every Tuesday, from Kansas every Tuesday night. It's a pretty good hike just to go to Naomi. She says, well, it beats hell out of a bolt of lightning, doesn't it, Gary? And so that convinced us that maybe we ought to go. And we moved here in 77. At that time, Indianapolis had 50 AA meetings a week, and all but one or two of them were speaker meetings. And while, you know, Denver had gone the California way too, and had lots of both speaker meetings and discussion meetings. But I was looking for somebody who took the 12 steps and who knew something about the big book. And the only person I could find was a lady here on the south side of Indianapolis, Peggy O'Neill. You talk about Irish, but she had been through the book and the steps, and she had the gal she had would talk about the book and the steps, and that was it. But I couldn't find a man that had much experience with that. Time went by, and I was going to meetings, and I was a new guy in town, so guess who gets to speak at open meetings in smaller towns? It's a new kid, so I was shooting my mouth. Tara talking about my experience of going through the steps with the group. And I get a call from the worst redneck I'd ever met in my life. He wanted to have one of those meetings in a basement where we could go through the steps together. He said, I'm going to start it next Wednesday. And I said, good. Will you come? I said, of course. And so, as I recall, there was eight of us, eight men that went and do that. And when these guys went out and did that, they were so excited. They'd gone through the book. They were so excited. They'd go out and round up other groups and take them through the book and the steps. And they started calling them workshops here in town. Average time for one of those is 16 weeks to go through the first seven chapters. And it goes a little longer if you take it to the whole full 164 pages. And so now if you came and you heard a speaker at a meeting, they're more likely to talk to you about how they acted in AA and what happened to them after they went through the steps in this workshop stuff. And it worked. It worked fine. So I got to thinking I was really a big shot, and got to mishandling my money again and our money again. Damn near lost the house. And quite a bit of infidelity being involved in that. And I'm in more and more pain. And I know I'm in trouble. And I'd met a man named Paul Martin from Chicago. He's gone now, but and when he was well into his 60 years of sobriety. But Paul Martin, step Nazi if there ever was one. And I'd heard him talk two or three times and met him once. And I called him and I told him, I said, I can't remember the exact words, but I was in real trouble. And I let him know I was in real trouble. And I called him and he had me go through the first three steps quickly. He said, write a number of inventory and then come up here and you can take some fifth steps. And I didn't hear what he said. I was just hoping I knew I had an answer. And so I did that. And I called him and went up there, and he told me the motel to go to. I got there just long enough to go get a cup of coffee at the gas station across the street. There's a knock on my door, and it's an Irishman named Dennis O'Brien. And Dennis says, I'm here to swap fifth steps with you. I'll go first so you know what to do. And Dennis was 29 years sober, and I was 23 years sober. And we'd written a lot of inventory. We know how to write inventory without getting into the drama. Drama's not needed. You want to get down to the selfishness, the self-centeredness, the dishonesty, the fear, and all of that. And so we could do that. So He sat and he shared his, and I shared mine. Then we compared notes because I picked up some stuff he missed, and he picked up some stuff I missed. Had time to go get another copy off Dennis Giff, and a guy named David shows up. And he's a tough-talking street guy who's a successful stockbroker, but he sounds like he's still out in the street bumping heads. And we do the same thing. And by the Saturday night at bedtime, I'd done that with 9 different men, ranging from 35 years of sobriety down to 2 or 3 years. And I was stunned because the guys in it was 2 or 3 years had made all their amends or still in the middle of making those amends on payment basis and that sort of thing. And I met some of them for breakfast the next morning. After breakfast, they said, get your pad and pencil out. I'm going to help you with your 8th step. And they did and had really good memories. And so we did. We wrote out my amends list. And it was a lot of money, a lot of people. And I wasn't picking up bad checks this time, but I'd borrowed money from AA members and from parents and you name it. We did a lot of money. And I came home after that Sunday afternoon and told Julie what we were up against. And she'd been with me when I did a lot of that. She says, Gary, those are our amends. They're not just yours. And so we sat down and made out the plan and started paying. It worked pretty. It's pretty simple. You get some money. You got your list of amends. You pay who you can till you run out of money. Buy groceries and gas and shoes for the kids. And do that again the next payday. We'd done that for several weeks. And I came down one day and said, I don't think I can ever make enough money to pay all this lost stuff. And I was really looking for some sympathy. And that was the wrong lady to present that to. So the next morning, I come downstairs. And she says she has an idea. She says, Gary, you've been pretty successful in this business. And you got that 401k, and I don't know what it is, but it's a pretty good chunk for retirement. And with this house is appreciated pretty much, pretty good. I think we could sell the house, cash in the retirement, go buy a mobile home someplace. She said trailer house, not mobile home. I use mobile home because it sounds classier. So we did that. I called Paul that night when I got home, and I says, I think we're talking about selling the house and cashing in the 401k and paying all amends and moving into a mobile home. And I says, how crazy does that sound? He says, Gary, that's the sanest thing I've ever heard you say. Was it your idea? And I said, no, it was Julie's. And he said he thought so. And right up to the day he died, he was Julie's biggest fan. So anyway, we did that. Made a lot of amends, and one of them was a big amend to a man in AA who was a circuit speaker and a good friend. And he lives in Minnesota most of the time, and he hides out down in Mexico some of the time. But he had helped me keep my house one time, and they were about to foreclose on it. And I called him, and he laughed when I called him and told him I had the money. And I said, what's so funny? He said, well, cowboys like this. Back then, when I had that money to give you, I was in a business syndicating real estate, taking advantage of huge deductions for depreciation. Congress changed the law, and you can no longer syndicate that stuff like that. That was a gimmick that went around. A lot of people made a lot of money doing that in real estate, oil wells, cattle, all about this huge depreciation. But they changed the law, and all of a sudden, he had all these investors wanting their money, and he was interested. But he wasn't telling anybody on the shirt. Called his sponsor every day and talked about it. And he says, you know, Gary, I was helping all these other people out there doing that. Linda and I would pray what to do. That was our tithe. And he says, now I'm sitting there and I'm in trouble financially. He says, I go down to the post office once in a while and get the mail, and there'll be a check in it. And so I'm over around the country where Linda and I help people out. So I got to be part of a deal that just goes around and comes back around. That's like carrying the message for AA or carrying it whatever we do to help one another with that. There's many amends there I took like that, and I'd be happy to tell you, but there's some drama behind it, and I've probably talked too long now. Today, The last week and a half has been a little difficult for us. In our lives, years ago, shortly after we moved out here, our middle daughter had a little boy in 1980 named Timothy. And he, of course, was the first grandbaby we had in that. And Timothy's dad at that point in time had a huge problem, at least as bad as mine. And he wasn't around long. And so Patty was staying with us and raising the baby, and we did a lot to help Timmy and all that over time. We had a closer relationship than most grandparents have with their grandchildren. They love them all. You can't help but love grandbabies. But he became a problem from the get. He got kicked out of school completely. No, don't come back. The third time he got busted for being drunk in school at 15 years old. And there was no slowing him down at that point. And he was booted out of the house after that. His daughter was 18 months old, and her half-sister was 2 weeks old when the cops delivered him to his mother's door. And he's never seen him since. That was right. He was not allowed to even go back home to see his mom or stepdad and that whole time. And so we were kind of the guy, I was the guy that Bill, I promised him somewhere around in there that I'd do everything I can to keep him alive. We did, gosh, we got him into several different treatment centers and halfway houses, and Salvation Army and all of that. We'd pick him up out of the emergency rooms, or he was being beaten so badly. He wasn't a big kid. And had to go pick him up after he'd been violently raped a couple of times. And that he came out of that with more sanity than I think I've seen from any of it. Maybe the booze helped, I don't know. But anyway, he had been this last few, 2-3 years, I think. He was doing all right. He could work part-time every time at Lucas Oil Station where the Colts play. That he could go down and make good money cleaning up after whatever events they had there. And he mowed lawns. He lived in the worst neighborhood in Indianapolis. Gunfire up there just about every night anymore. But he would mow lawns for all the people up there. And there were just some elderly people that would do that and give him a little bit for it. But the COVID-19 took that away. But I 2 weeks ago, this past Thursday, I went up there and gave him some money so he could go down and get some groceries and we'd visit. So every time we'd go up by and see him, he'd tell us he loved us. I love you, Grandma. I love you, Grandpa. And we knew that, and he knew that we wouldn't have been there if we hadn't loved him. A week ago yesterday, we're sitting at home about 9:30 at night, and this Jay, it's his friend and landlord where he was staying up there in the hood. He called me. He says, "I got the most horrible call I've ever had to make." And we've been expecting that call for years, but that didn't help. So when Jay called and told him that he'd been drinking for 2 days, and at 2 o'clock that afternoon, he went down to his room. And when Jay didn't see me, he went down to check on him, and he found him dead. Julie and I were just sitting on the couch with that. We've been expecting that for ever. And that's a hard hit. And for anybody, I'm sure there's people out here. You got 75 people on right here, David, here right now. I'm sure I'm not the only one that went through this, but this is our recent experience. It's boiled down now that they probably cremated him yesterday. And Friday, his mom took the urn down to him, but I guess it's going to stay here. We've got one of those fireplaces, those see-through fireplaces. So there's a mantle on one side and a mantle on the other side. There's a spot there for Tim to stay. We don't know who gets to him after we go, but it doesn't matter. But this is kind of what we've been going through. And I've told people I talk to often, the ones I work with, some of the guys in my home group and gals, and that somehow the word of that's gotten around the world. And we've gotten condolences, cards, and messages, and texts. God, thank God for text messages, phone calls, and that. And so here I am, 55 years sober, delighted that I've had a life in AA that was just been wonderful. And it's capped off by all of the loving people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I seem to care for us and care for all of that. So you can take it over to whatever you mean is going to do now, sir, and I'll get my gear together.
Thank you, Gary. I'm going to allow everyone to unmute and say thank you. That was wonderful.
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you, Gary. That was great.
Gary.
Very
good. Gary. Absolutely wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sorry for your loss.
Blessings,
Gary.
Thank you, Gary.
Blessings.
Prayers. That was good.
All right, I'm going to take the meeting back. And I'll remind everyone to please submit your questions via chat to the user questions. I'm going to post a link to the Simple Actions PayPal account, consistent with the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level. Lost my place. Seventh tradition's essential, right? Sure. It's both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their inner group, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I'd be happy to take a couple of announcements if there are any. Just raise your virtual hand. Seeing none. Let's see. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting tonight. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available after we close this meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. So that being said, we are going to come back and we're getting some questions in here. Gary, thank you again so much. That was wonderful.
My pleasure.
So, got a question here. Did those men who carried the message to you in treatment stick to their own stories? Did they talk about steps or sponsorship?
That was a long time ago. I don't remember that, no. I was so foggy then trying to snap out of it, David. I don't remember really what they said. They'd introduce themselves and talk about, maybe give a dry date. I don't remember that. But I really don't, I can't tell you. I don't remember.
Okay. And you told the Eskimo story. And I think you said that man who said that he had had an eye on you knew where you were every day since you were 16 years old. Yeah, you never saw him. You never saw him again after that?
Not that I remember. No, I don't think I did. I'm sure he was probably close enough to retirement at that night when he picked me up at the bus station. But I don't remember seeing him after that. Shame, isn't it?
Yeah. A member asks, what does the term pigeon mean to you?
Yeah. Sponsee is a better word. That's just what we called him that in the young people's group, and I never outgrew it, I guess. That's all. It's not meant to be insulting in any way, shape, or form.
All right. You know, I heard Bob Olson tell that Denver 14 story, and so you were part of that, and so 14 people set out to go line by line through the book, and the one fella pulled out, froze to death in the doorway, and the other 13 remained sober to this day, or died that way.
Yes.
And I didn't know until tonight you were part of that. Did Don Pritz lead that group?
Yes and no. Don had the most knowledge about the 12 steps. Most of us were going into the big book as green as can be. One of us had 7 years sobriety, and I don't know if he'd cracked the book open more than once or twice in that year. And a little bit of a wild man. He's the one that has the most sobriety. He's still alive. He's totally blind, lives in Las Vegas. And he really likes pretty girls, and he can't see them. Now, we always think that's too bad. Don was the real guide for that. And he took Bob Olson under his pocket as his primary sponsor, too. And so Bob talks about him a lot.
All right. Let's see. I have another question. You mentioned you used the phrase California way. You'd said that primarily AA meetings were speaker meetings, but then you said California way. Was California that sort of the pioneers in this open discussion sort of model that we find ourselves in today? Or maybe you didn't mean that.
Well, that's my observation. Most of speaking, the closer we were to Akron and that sort of thing, those were nearly always speaker meetings with a heavy evangelical effort to get people to come in and get sober with that. But the discussion meetings seemed to come from the West, as I remember that, and that they would talk. Somebody traveling would come through. And a lot of them, the traveling salesmen generally came from California rather than New York or the East Coast, if you lived in Wyoming and Colorado. And they brought stuff from Texas and all that. But I'm very fond of the speaker meetings. I always have been. I learned how to do steps and help people through steps and all that through the discussion kind of thing. But I think I've learned more from tidbits you pick up from various speakers. I've gotten good stuff from bad speakers as much as I have from good speakers. So I'm partial to them. Still am at this point. But I've been talking so much on this Zoom thing right now. I'm glad to see I got nothing on my calendar. So give me a break.
Well, we're glad you're here tonight. Let's see, we have another question. How glaring are your defects today?
Well, I'm not sure that changes. Selfishness, self-centeredness is clearly the root of my problem. And that's true with many years of sobriety, as it is early in sobriety with that. So they're always out there. They're laying for me to slip. And do something like that, and it'll happen to them. And it can be just kind of anything, but and look, that's something. It could be something as little as being selfish enough to kind of get in front of the guy I should have waited for, or something much more serious than that. That I've done that. Julie has Parkinson's right now, and has had it now for several years. It's progressive, and it makes things more and more difficult for her. You see the tremors, and you know that's it, but we don't see the tiredness, the exhaustion that you have when they do that with that. And there's some pain involved here on occasion. It's not constant. And so I can be a little, when I'm trying to help and do everything around the house, I get this stupid thought going through, man, I'd sure like a break here. And I can take that on out, you know, another degree or more. I'm not aware of any, I can tell you that I lied to my wife, and I quickly turned around and I said, that's not true. And she says, I know it wasn't. our defects, we ask God to remove them, but all it takes is one little thing where I'm thinking, by God, I should have got that instead of that monkey. And I can do that. I mean, that's part of what we're all about. Selfishness and self-centeredness never stops being our biggest problem.
All right. Let's see. We got a couple more questions left. Feel free to send them. We've got time. I often hear the phrase, check your motives. How can one do that? How do you check your motives?
Well, you pay attention. That sounds pretty glib. Let's look at it this way. Our 10th step is really clear in the big book, where it says, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God to remove it right away. We discuss it with somebody quickly. We make amends quickly if we have harmed somebody. And we turn our thoughts to someone we can help. The 10th step is not the nightly review. When Bill went from the big book to the 12 and 12, he lost the 10th step. He's writing the 12 and 12 in the midst of the worst depression he had in his entire life. He just missed it. With that, it has nothing to do. They're two different things. The 10th step is mean, continue to watch, and when they crop up, do those things. It's simple. We were talking about Olson. I had some kind of resentment hitting me, and I called Bob, the 10th step, said I had a resentment, and he said, did you ask God to remove it? And I said, no, and he said, call me back, and he hung up on me. And so I've never forgot to say that prayer since then, but I called back, went back through that. And I've never gotten a chance. He'll call me with 10 steps and we'll go through the same process because he never forgets to pray. So with it, but yes, that's how you do it. You're just watching yourself, how you behave. If something scares you bad enough, you lie. Or if you think you need a little more money and you lie to do, most of my things are going to be around life. That's pay attention. And I wasn't trying to be a smart ass when I said that.
No. Maybe this is a good segue. You talked about the 10th step. A lot of people are interested in your 11th step practice today.
Well, my procedure is irregular. I take some time in the day to sit. I do two things. Paul Martin, when we were going through the amends, he would call me and ask me about my meditation, and it was almost nothing. And he says, I'm going to send you a book, and I think with your mind, the way it runs amok, would be good for you. And the Russian and Greek Orthodox churches do ceaseless prayer. And ceaseless prayer, in this case, and what he taught me was, they'll say over and over and over again, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner. And the book he gave me to read was called The Way of the Pilgrim. And it's a story of a crippled pilgrim in Russia, reading the lines in there where Paul says to pray without ceasing. And he says, this guy's, how do you do that? Well, that's crazy. How do you do that? And he found a monk who told him how to do that. And it's a wonderful story to read with that, because the story has to do with the people he works with as a crippled pilgrim going around Russia and learning to do that. It's a fun book. But I did that and learned that. And I've done it so long that hold on, back up a minute. I've done that for a long time, and that's kind of constantly me. And sometimes I don't invite that prayer to come in. Sometimes it'll just be there, particularly if I'm uncomfortable, I get cut off in traffic. It can kind of be anything, and then it'll just start up with that. And many of the people I've sponsored found that more useful to do. For me to sit and try to do centering prayer, today, after all these years of trying to do that, I'll use that mantra to do some centering prayer. But most of the time, that prayer is going on and show up uninvited. And I've been doing that for, gosh, probably close to 40 years. And sometimes I just sit and do it. This time of year, just to my right here is a little covered patio. And it's a great place to sit and do that. I do read some things that I like to read, but I'm not locked into anything other than that. And that sounds pretty freewheeling, and that's pretty much my nature. And it's worked very well for me for a long time. And a bunch of the guys I sponsor do that too.
Do you attribute that? That's interesting that you said that prayer sort of visits you kind of against your own will. Is that just the result of practice, and muscle memory, or grace, or it's interesting?
How about all of the above?
Okay. Yeah, there's something there.
Good. I hope it helps you. Call me if you want to talk about it.
Okay. All right. We have another question. What do you think are some things AA used to do that work that you don't see anymore?
Crosstalk. Crosstalk was very effective in my early days in AA. Big Frank McKibben, I'd hear more things when he tells somebody to shut up in the room and explain them the fact of life. With that. No, we don't do it in my group. My home group is when we're all together, there's a discussion meeting that has 55 or 60 people at it. And everybody gets a chance to talk because we, the way we're set up, if they want to, if they haven't been called on. But I'll take somebody out after the meeting's over and have a chat with them in the parking lot and all of that. I'm surprised more people haven't done this more on this Zoom thing and all of that. In fact, I did a little bit. I spoke somewhere. That was a talk I gave out in Hawaii last week. And I shared more about the amends than I had time for today with that. And two of the people there were clearly new in the meeting. And both of them said, the only person I owe amends to is myself. And I asked them to rethink that, because I guaranteed them they'd caused a hell of a lot more harm to other people than they ever did to themselves. And I thought that was pretty close as far as I could go.
That was common in the old days. The old timers would just straighten you out right there in the meeting.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's why we were much more effective. One of the reasons.
Okay. Is there anything else on that topic before we move on?
No, not now. I'm sorry.
Okay. A member asks, to what do you attribute your longevity in AA?
A variety of things. I probably goes back to my the beginning for me. I fell in love with AA somewhere in there when we were hanging with the young people. And we were all very busy, and we did so much together. And one of the guys that disagreed would disappear. If we didn't see him for a couple of 3 days, we'd go looking for him with that, because we cared for him back then. Old Joe disappeared for 3 days because he had a new girlfriend. He told us to get the hell out of there. But I just fell in love with everything about it. We'd drive for miles to take meetings to Fort Morgan, Colorado, or Pueblo, and things like that. Whether they invited us or not, we'd show up there and do that. I think in my case, Alcoholics Anonymous was the first place I was ever comfortable in my own skin. And I hope to bring anybody that comes in here to get to that place and all that. And I love it. I still think that about it, and love everything about it. Julie and I spent last night up at an AA friend's house. She has this huge big patio, and we could stay socially distant and had a wonderful evening and that beautiful night at her place, listening to music and jaw-jacking. So.
Nice. Somebody would like for you to repeat the name of that book and the prayer that you use.
The prayer is, can be lengthened or shortened. If you read it, you'll find it. The last time I read it in there, it's, Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me, a sinner. But you'll see people doing that same thing and just say, Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Catholic Church says, you know, Lord, have mercy. Works out. The book, the Way of the Pilgrim is the name of the book, and you can find it on Amazon and get used one. And the translation I like the best, I think the man's name was Fleming, F-L-E-M-I-N-G. And even if you don't take up the prayer as part of your life, that book's enjoyable. It's a fun story.
And it seems the value too is the unceasing nature. It could almost be anything that anyone wants to put in there, but to offer it continuously and frequently.
Is that, well, yeah, that it is with me. It shows up uninvited sometimes. A few Advents ago, three or four other guys and I went to listen to a nun named Mary Margaret Funk, and she was having a men's retreat at Advent, and she wanted to us to sit and do some kind of contemplative stuff, meditation, before we started the meeting for 5 minutes. And then she listed them off, from centering prayer to unceasing prayer and all the others. And she said she didn't care. And that's the first time I'd heard the term unceasing prayer, or ceaseless prayer. And so after all the other guys left, I said, I do that ceaseless prayer. And she said, oh, really? Where did you learn to do that? And I said, it's my AA sponsor. And she says, tell me about him. And at that time, he was probably well into his 40s or maybe older. Then I told him up there, and I said, he's a very bright man, and he introduced me to the Way of the Pilgrim. And my thought is, he probably has it memorized. He's one of those that could pick up and look at something and walk away and never have to look at it again. And she says, oh, I would like to meet him. They never got it done and all that. But if you want to see some interesting reading, Google Mary Margaret Funk to pick up some of the stuff she wrote.
Mary Margaret what?
Funk, F-U-N-K.
Okay. Well, Gary, you have been more than generous with your time. We have just one more question before we close. I wonder if you might just say a few words about being a home group member, the value of a home group. What has that done for you? What does that mean to you? What would you like to share about that?
Well, first off, it's very important to me. My first home group, of course, was the Young People's Group in Denver. With that, and then When we moved out here, I guess I've only had two of them, I think about it. When we moved out here, we had experience where the nearby church where Julie and I lived down in the southeast side of town. And we started meeting there, and that was the beginning of our group. Our group initially was called, it was a men's group, and it was called the Dignitary Sympathy Group. And there weren't any dignitaries, and there sure wasn't hardly any sympathy. that wasn't there. But dignitary sympathy groups, there's a small number of them around the country, and they're all men's meetings. They're not co-ed meetings. And so we were doing that, Don P. said, I can't come to your meeting. If all the alcoholics can't come, it's not an AA meeting. I won't go to it. And it's only men that can go to it. And so that started with that. And we had the greatest group conscious meeting you ever heard when we changed that and got rid of it. So it's now called the Digs. We shortened it because we went co-ed years ago. And so we just call ourselves the Digs, and not the for somebody who knew about the Dignitary Sympathy Groups, that we didn't want to confuse them when they walked into ours. But that's been my home group. There were times I was going to meetings, 7, 8, 9 times a week, but I always had a home group, and this was it. The young people's group, and then this one.
Right. Thank you. All right, we're gonna go ahead and close the meeting down, and we'll give everyone an opportunity after the prayer to say thank you again. And I'm gonna share my screen here and ask BJ to read the last few paragraphs on page 164.
My name is BJ, I'm an alcoholic.
I'm BJ.
This is taken from A Vision for You from the Big Book, page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Wonderful. Thank you everyone for participating tonight. Thank you, Larry, for catching the questions. Thank you, Gary. Let's just have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. You can unmute if you like. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.
Amen. Woohoo!
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you so much,
Gary.
Thank you, 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 Gary. Thanks, Gary. Great. Appreciate it.